Recordings have started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the 34th GNSOEPDP team meeting taking place on the 13th of December 2018 at 1400 UTC. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no one, we have listed apologies from Cavus, Aristov, Gack, and Thomas Rickard of the ISPCP. They have formally assigned Raul Goslin as their alternative for this call in any remaining days of absence. During this period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls until the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment form must be formalized by the way of the Google assignment form. The link is available in the agenda pod to the right and in the meeting invite email. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. Seeing or hearing no one, if you need assistance, oh, I apologize. One moment. Emily Taylor, please go ahead.
Hi, just a very quick update to my statement of interest. I wanted to let everyone know that Necestral, the registrar that I'm a shareholder in, has recently entered into an agreement to provide white label software services to our last resort, whose representative Benedict Addis is also on this team, so I just wanted to highlight that connection. I wouldn't normally bring these sort of matters to the team, but given that we're both on the EPDP, I thought it was appropriate to mention. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. If you do need assistance updating your statements of interest, please email the GNSO Secretariat. All documentation and information can be found on the EPDP Wiki space. There is an audio cast and view-only connect for non-members to follow the call. So please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. Thank you, and with this, I'll turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Hi, thanks very much, Terry, and hello, everyone. I hope everybody's in good shape today. I'm going to rejigger the agenda just a little bit. In today's meeting, we want to talk about, specifically, we want to talk about the geographic basis and how geography has an effect on where GDPR applies and not. We've had discussions on that in the past. We have recently received Data Protection Board guidelines that may or may not affect our discussion, so we want to get into that. There's a section of the initial and final reports that are a requirement. That's the policy change impact analysis. So they were included in the initial report, and we want to review them to determine if they're complete enough for that. And then there are some additional topics that were added to our topic list that we've appended to the end of the agenda, so I hope we can get to them. So, but what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about our approach to securing external legal counsel. And so if we have a slide deck to put up. Yesterday, the TCST met, and I'm not even sure what that stands for, but it's the ICANN staff group that manages the budgets of the policy efforts. And so when we want to secure a budget for a particular effort, we go to them. And so even though we have an approved budget, to release that budget requires this processing. So it's it's running a pretty good way. There's a small team that includes David Olive and Xavier and other finance and policy staff and our support team, and we make our pitches, and it usually goes pretty well. And this meeting went well too, and it's very much due to Barry Cobb's work in preparing slides and the arguments and discussions and framing it up. So we secure this secure the resources. So in this case, there's been. I'm going to shut off Skype. So in this case, as you know, securing outside legal counsel has a recent but rich history in ICANN, where lots of money's been spent on this service, and so there's special attention paid on it being managed well. So in getting approval for getting outside legal counsel, we wanted to find that intersection of getting the help we need and managing it well, which we would do in any case. So, you know, my rule for running things is because you have budget, if you don't need to spend it, you shouldn't. And if you need to do something, you need to do it, whether the budget's there or not. So we only want to spend money when we absolutely have to. So with that, I'm going to go through this slide deck kind of quickly, but then you can have it. And this is the slide deck that was presented to this PCST. So I wanted to present an abbreviated version, but I thought it'd be better to. The slides are moving. So I thought it'd be better to show you everything. So, you know, we're modeling this approach on the framework that was used for cross-community group or something about accountability, so or the IANA transition. So who's scrolling the slides? So go back to the agenda. Yeah, so we're going to talk about that a bit, the rationale we provided to the PCST, the composition of a team that will be the interface between us and the outside legal services, how it'll run, what kind of our principles are, and then budget that we don't care about too much. So let's go on to the next slide. Thank you. And so the slide's just a tiny bit too big. I don't know if you can make it perfect or not, but if not, this is good. So we want to use the same sort of framework that's been successfully used in the past. So we'll have what we'll call, for lack of a better term, a legal committee that will pass the questions on to the outside legal counsel. And the role of this committee is, you know, to take our questions. And I think the key, I'll talk more about this in a second, but the key part of this will be to make sure the questions are in the right shape, and that is that they're clear, concise, and so that we get and configured in a way or composed in a way that we get an answer back that's helpful to us. And I think for me, that's sort of our biggest challenge, is wording these questions up in a way that we get back a helpful and clear answer. And with our own questions so far, we've gone through a couple iterations of them and not achieved that yet. So I think that's where we're going to have the most of our effort. And then what they will do in addition to that, we're going to go through the process a little bit later, so I'll describe that. And, you know, this legal committee will be composed of a chair, maybe somebody who's not on this call today. You know, it'll include Rafiq and I and the team. So this team should be and what I can't stand for first, I think what we prefer too is that it be staffed with attorneys or people with legal training or legal background. So my preferred composition for the team would be not more than one person from each group, and that person having legal training or legal background, although there can be exceptions made to that, especially if you don't have a lawyer in your group. I think that's the preferred composition. And then we'll have policy support staff. So some of those people listed in the policy support staff. So we'll want to form this legal committee pretty fast. And, you know, I also have ideas for who might be on it, but if each group wants to think about which attorney-like person they'd want to nominate, that'd be great, too. The next slide. So this was what was presented to the PCS team that, you know, we have, you know, we've developed questions that are legal, not policy, that where there's uncertainty as to how GDPR applies and that they're on the critical path to us finishing the final report. We noted that the CCWG Workstream 2 had an effective model for doing that, that we'd manage the work in a way that it was economically efficient, and that we would, you know, provide a process that managed as well. So the process, as I see it, is essentially this, and this is how I see it. But this is Barry's work, but I agree with it, and that, you know, us as a team have been formulating questions to pass on. We first thought to maybe the Data Protection Board, but now it would be outside legal counsel. And so the committee would just make sure the question is, in fact, a legal question, that it's in good form. And if it's not in good form and is reworded, that would probably have to go back to the full group, unless it's just a tiny tweak. And if there's full representation on the group, then the group can make that judgment whether it needs to go back to the full group or not. And then it will manage that. And the way it will manage that, the questions is, the way I see it is, you know, maybe this team will get together and look at the GDPR and look at, you know, advice such as the geographic advice we just got, and say, well, the answer to this question is pretty clear. We think we can answer it ourselves. They might go to ICANN and say, you know, has this question been answered yet? Is it in the Hamilton memo? I don't want to task this group with a lot of, this legal committee with a lot of research to see if it's answered elsewhere, but I think we could do a little, but we could employ ICANN too. We could say, hey, here's our question. Has this been answered anywhere else? The slides have grouped and I've lost my place. And then, you know, absent being able to be easily answered in a very short period of time, then the group would send the question on to outside legal counsel. So it's a processing flow that I think has been used in the past, but I think it'll work really quickly in practice because, you know, you get a group of eight or so people sitting around the table, six or eight people sitting around the table, and the answers to those questions will become pretty clear, or they can be passed on to ICANN, where an answer would come across right away. I ask that in the statement of work that ICANN will use the statement of work we created and beat it up a little bit probably, and I asked that we put in a time frame for where we wanted questions answered, so many business days or something like that, in order to in order to expedite the process. And I also asked that in the case that there's an exchange of writing and the answer is still not clear, and we think that a conference call with a law firm would be helpful, that be included in the statement of work also as a way to balance costs, but mostly to ensure we get answers as soon as possible. So that's the process. Pretty, I think it's be pretty lightweight for us. So here's a set of guidelines, you know, the principals that manage the group. And I don't think, you know, I've already said quite a few of these things, so I'll just let you look at this slide for a second. You know, this slide mainly concerns seeing if the question is already answered in some other place. And again, I would think we can rely on ICANN to do some of this research for us. And then I'm just letting you read these bullets here. Thanks, very good timing. And here's a budget slide. You can avert your eyes from this one if you want. At some point, I think Barry should give a quick briefing to our group about where we stand in the budget. I think it'd be, I find it interesting, and there's some surprises. So that's it. So this plan was approved by ICANN yesterday. So I'm presuming they're energized and going about looking for the outside services. I don't remember during the call, and so I want to make sure that Christine brought up the issue of conflicts in our last call. So, Barry, if you could remind me or make a note to the team that's procuring this, that we take that into account. So that's essentially it. So, I hope that this happens in fairly short order. If there's any suggestions or recommendations that we should be passing on to ICANN and making this procurement, or if you have any questions about how this will run, you know, I think the way this runs is pretty clear, but it'll become a lot clearer once we start doing it. So not 100% of the questions will be answered. Yeah, so some of us think Thomas might be the chair, too. Emily?
Hi. I know I've missed the last few calls, so this might well have been discussed on the calls in relation to getting external legal advice, but I just did want to say that I have some reservations about whether we're going to really get as much value from this exercise as we think we are. I mean, I know that so many people on this group are very experienced in instructing lawyers and getting legal advice or being lawyers. So I don't want to tell you things that you already know, but it's so difficult for any lawyer to be instructed by a group that has divergent interests. Lawyers will normally tailor their advice to what they perceive to be their client's objectives and interests. Where we have a group this diverse, which is unable to agree almost on what day of the week it is, let alone nuanced legal questions or the detail of GDPR, I really do question whether we are going to get value for money or anything that couldn't just be read out of a textbook, because the lawyers will react by just playing it safe and repeating back what the articles of the GDPR say. There's not been very much guidance. There's also been, of course, a lot of legal analysis done in respect of who is going back over the centuries, it seems, from the Article 29 group days back in the mid-2000s, to the very detailed advice that informs the temporary specification. So I just wanted to highlight this. I think that we could end up spending a huge amount of time, a huge amount of money, and not necessarily being any the wiser for it. Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. So I think this, that we've marched down, I don't know exactly what order to say all this in. So we marched down this path where we're going to ask questions to the Data Protection Board, and then we decided, or pretty much decided as a group, to not do that for a few reasons. And so then, but we do have questions that are not policy, but they're legal. And when I say legal, I mean, you know, if we create a policy or a specification that says this, will that be GDPR compliant? And so we want to get some indication of that before issuing a final report. And so we've decided, and you guys correct me if I'm screwing this up, but we've decided to pursue this in two ways. One is to procure outside legal advice, and two is to contact perhaps DPAs directly. And I think Stephanie suggested the one in Belgium with our questions. So we want to pursue answers to those questions using those two avenues. So, and this is one of those avenues. And I think you know, you may be right, but I think we'll learn the value of it pretty fast. And if we find out it has no value, then we'll stop, not for the money, but also, as you said, I don't want to waste our time. The second point I want to make is, I think, you know, in our discussions, we've orally develop questions for the Data Protection Board or somebody that needs to be answered. And when trying to put those questions down on paper with some specificity, we find ourselves sort of disagreeing about what the wording of the question is or how it should be put. And I think for those questions where we do have uncertainty, it's a very worthwhile and important exercise just to write the question down. I think we all have an idea of what the questions are, but we have different takes on them. And so I think it'd be a good consensus building tool to actually write the questions down with the specificity required to give to someone to answer. I think that would be very instructive for us. So those are my two answers to your question, but we go into this with eyes open and understanding all the warnings you've just given. James?
Hey, Kurt. James speaking, and I think my comments are probably compatible or aligned with Emily. So this is certainly not the first time that Work on Who Is has sought some sort of legal expertise. I'm not opposed to formally and undertaking this approach. I just want to be sure that we have, like you said, eyes wide open, that we can get these groups to agree on which questions need to be asked and how they need to be formulated and to whom they should be, asked and what experts qualify. But really what I want more than anything is some degree of assurance that whatever comes out of this process, if a legal expert says, you know, you guys should be doing this, that this group actually takes it on board. I think my concern is that over the years of receiving legal advice on who is an RDS, really hasn't moved the needle in terms of where folks' positions are. So, I agree with you. I think we need to kind of kick this off. It's probably overdue, and certainly we don't want to be developing final recommendations in a vacuum and have some legal authority come in at the 11th hour and blow them all up. So I think that this is it is important work, but I just want us to be very mindful of the challenges that we have not been able to overcome in the past, and hopefully have some fresh, blank page approach this time around so that this actually benefits our work. Thanks.
Yes, James, well put. And I just want to reiterate that I think the hardest, the most important part of this exercise is actually formulating the questions. Hi, Hadia, how are you today?
Thank you. So part of my question is a little bit of what James was saying. My question actually is to Emily and to all of us. In case we receive precise legal advice that guides towards a certain path, are we willing, as different stakeholder groups, to accept the advice and follow it, even if the advice is against the position of the stakeholder group, of the precise stakeholder group? Is this stakeholder group, will the stakeholder group that this position is against to accept the advice?
Yeah, so, James says I disagree. Yeah, so to answer James and Hadia's question, I think you can't. So I'm not sure you can make people agree with legal advice we receive or accept it. I think it makes it much harder for someone in a open and transparent environment such as ours to disagree with advice once received. And I think that, if we think the advice is competent, then, it makes it much harder for one to put up an opinion in a final document or a public document that will most likely be discredited when published. So I think there's forces that will help us towards agreement on that. But it's really hard to predict the form of the answer we'll receive and whether that requires any interpretation. So I think it's really hard to make a rule that whatever answer we receive from legal counsel that will be binding. Yeah, so Ashley said in one sentence what I said in four, and she said it better. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. This is Alex for the record. Yeah, so I support this work. I think it's important, especially if we're not comfortable in reaching out with the European Data Protection Board. It seems to me that instead of asking questions, we should be drafting detailed scenarios that kind of describe the decisions or the decisions that we hope to make here in the EPDP working group. I think the question that we need to ask, legal counsel is each scenario compliant with the GDPR? I think if we were able to focus on detailing and explaining with as much content and context as possible the scenarios, that would hopefully put us in a better position to get an answer back that is informed and that we would all accept. Thanks,
Alex. Mark, you want to take us home on this one? Last comment.
I would love to take you home on this comment. Alex's comment is one that I support. I had made a very similar comment during the small group meetings. I think that if we are very clear, here's a use case, here's a proposed, and sorry, showing my end, but here's a use case, here's how we propose a solution to such a use case. Is that solution to that use case valid? Is it acceptable? What are your concerns about it? I think you could get pretty pretty focused and actionable advice if we do it that way. The more general the questions are, the more useless the advice will be. I think the challenge will be, you know, having a comprehensive gamut of specific use cases and solutions to ask questions about, I think, to get the good coverage.
Great, thanks. So thanks for all those constructive comments. Just looking at the chat. So Emily, I don't think so. I think they're supposed to inform our policy recommendations, but you know, what we're talking about here are, in our discussions, are conditional policy recommendations. And when I say conditional, I mean conditional based on the legal opinion we received. So there could be all sorts of shades of gray about how far down the path we are to a specific policy recommendation before we seek advice. But generally speaking, by the time we're seeking advice, I think, you know, we've honed the issue fairly well, and it hinges on some sort of decision, hinges on what the legal interpretation of GDPR is. All right, well, thank you very much for that, and thanks again to Barry for having the intestinal fortitude to take this to this PECST team and securing the budget for us. The next topic on the agenda is geographic basis, and this is where, you know, living in this really complex environment of the domain name industry and the DNS, that we turn to the TEM spec that governs how an entity's association with the EEA will determine whether it falls under the GDPR or not. And so fairly recently, Amr brought to our attention that the European Data Protection Board issued guidelines regarding how GDPR attaches, given different geographic scenarios. And I read with great interest each one of the scenarios, hoping that this would be our scenario. And some of them came a little close. So some of them are kind of concerning, especially about having to have a representative in the European Union if you fall under GDPR. So, but that's not really our concern. So I want to have a discussion about any clarity that this memo provides to our discussion as to whether or not, as to under what conditions registrars and registries had to comply with GDPR, given their business model, geographic reach, places for processing data, location of their customers, et cetera. And so at the very last moment, I've asked Amr if he would start the discussion with sort of what his, since he brought the memo to our attention, the guidelines to our attention, what his take on it was, and how, if at all, the scenarios in the memo or the rules outlined affected our discussion. So if you don't mind, Amr, I'll turn the microphone over to you, and gratefully.
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amr. As Kurt said, these guidelines were shared by the EDPB a few weeks ago, and my understanding is that they're kind of available for a sort of a public process right now. So they may change in the future. We don't know to what extent that may happen, but it's a good resource to take a look at right now. And to be honest, I do have a few takeaways from these guidelines, but I think, to me, they've raised more questions than added certainty. And I'll try to share some of my personal thoughts on those, and would be grateful to hear thoughts of others, of course. as we all know, we started the discussion on the, you know, the distinction between registered name holders by contracted parties on a geographic basis back in early October. We formed a small team that held two calls on this issue, and a number of arguments, for requiring this distinction to take place and against the requirements for the distinction to take place were put forward, and they were included in the initial report that was published by this team. To me, I think several of these arguments, really highlighted our perception of why it might be helpful or harmful to make this distinction. But I don't think any of us really addressed Article 3 in the GDPR directly. And that's kind of where these guidelines come in, and I think they add a bit more meat to what's already in there. And like I said, it's left me with really more questions than anything else. But, okay, in brief, the guidelines I've learned a few things from them, let's put it that way, that I wasn't aware of before. So the guidelines, I won't go through all of them, but I want to focus now on two issues, really. One is the application of the targeting criteria, which, to my surprise, when I was reading this, I discovered that, you know, just because a data subject is located within the EU or the EEA doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, processing activities concerning this data subject's data necessarily falls within the scope of GDPR, but there are some provisions that need to be met in order to, make this an actual requirement. One of them is that individuals in the EU are actually targeted by either the controller or a processor. And another one would be that the behavior of the data subject in the EU or the EEA is being actively monitored by a controller or a processor. And there, like Kurt said, there's a whole bunch of scenarios or examples of how those might take place. None of them are identical to what happens with ICANN, but yeah, some of them do actually come really close, particularly in terms of services concerning information that are provided, you know, like online services, such as the ones that are provided by contracted parties to registered name holders. And so one of the interesting things, one of the things that I thought might be applicable in our case in terms of monitoring behavior are some of the examples that were listed in the guidelines, such as behavioral advertisements or actually geolocalization activities. They specify that this might be particularly more relevant for marketing purposes, but other examples include online tracking using things like cookies, any sort of personalized targeting. I guess this is more relevant to targeting than it is monitoring the behavior. But, you know, for example, if a registrar is displaying its services in different in a language that is used within the EU or listing prices in a local currency. So these are a few more examples of what might trigger the applicability of GDPR under the targeting criteria, whether it's by targeting the behavior or directing an activity, which is another way they've put it, or by monitoring the behavior in the union. Another thing that I found to be interesting in the guidelines is the application of the establishment criteria. So we all know that ICANN is not, its main establishment is not within the EU. It's in California. A main establishment is not the only factor that applies, and this is something that is apparently already present in Article 3, and there's a recital, I think it's recital 225, I think it was, that indicates that, you know, that if there's any exercise or activity through a stable arrangement, and here that's where the idea of what a stable establishment might be. If that takes place within the EU, either by the controller or the processor, then again, GDPR becomes applicable. And one of the interesting things in this context as well is that the actual processing activity does not need to take place within the EU. So if a stable establishment within the EU is functioning on behalf of a controller or a processor, and the processing activity, regardless of whether it takes place within the EU or not, but has some sort of contextual relationship to the stable establishment, then again, my understanding of these guidelines is that GDPR would become applicable. Now, I found this to be especially interesting in the ICANN context because of because of the presence of the Brussels office and the extent to which, for example, ICANN, the Brussels office is in any way associated with development of ICANN policies that, consensus policies that end up finding their way into contracts with accredited registrars and registries, as well as, for example, remote staff. So one of the examples in the guidelines is that, you could just have a staff member who is providing a stable arrangement that is performing a function on behalf of a processor or a controller. So these are all things that I find interesting in the guidelines. I hope that as many of you as possible have gone through them. I do not claim any expertise on this at all. I mean, I just saw this and I read it, I went through it, and tried to get what I could out of it. But to me, reading this, like I said, it left me with more questions and ideas than it did answers and conclusions. I think, in the exercise of developing questions for legal advice, I think we might want to consider some of what we see in the guidelines here and try to get more, definitive, opinions by experts on what this means. So I guess what we might need, or what I believe we might need is some guidelines on the guidelines just to figure out, that are more specific to the case that we're dealing with here at ICANN. I don't know if there are any questions or comments, and maybe I should hand the cue back to Kurt. Thanks.
That was great, Amr. Can I have, I have a couple pointed issues about this input and how it might affect us, but could I have a show of hands of people that have either read it or skimmed it? Yeah, so that's pretty good. So, one of the questions to start a discussion about this, and then, I think I have some ideas about this. One question I had was about the targeting section of this, and whether registrars operating globally are targeting people inside the EU under the purpose of GDPR. And so to me, that I don't know what opinions people have about that. I see, I'm assuming this is a queue here. So Margie, if you want to go ahead, that'd be great.
Sure, this is Margie, and I also had a chance to take a look at this. I thought it was actually useful in that it identified a lot of areas where GDPR doesn't apply, and it actually seemed as though, just like Amr said, that one of the crux of the analysis is whether there's, activities targeting a registrant in the union. And so I think that helps us identify where the GDPR doesn't apply and might actually help us, you know, make the geographic distinction as we've been talking about in the past. It's not as difficult anymore with these guidelines. I do see areas where it'd be interesting to get additional legal advice on, as we talked, you know, we talked about earlier. And I also think that in reading this, that it's actually very important to get a solid understanding as to the relationship, like who is the controller, who is the processor, because the rules seem to be, you know, quite a bit differently depending upon whether it's a, you know, we've been debating in the other, you know, calls, whether it's a joint controller or independent controller or controller-processor relationship. So it seems that that's actually more important now given the way that they've delineated the responsibilities that flow from those relationships. So so I do think that you could use these guidelines to come up with scenarios of where it clearly doesn't apply, and we could perhaps even create a chart and talk to, you know, council once we have the council set up to confirm that the chart accurately describes, you know, the application.
Thanks, Margie. Go ahead, Diane. How are you today?
Oh, good. Thank you, Kurt. Agree with Margie and just want to take that point further because we've gone over this together. I think that this guidance is very helpful to us in two different ways. One is that it's clearly putting a responsibility on the controller and specifying that the processing activity is not the relevant controlling factor. So in the scenario where ICANN is a joint or sole controller, particularly in relation to who is information, they're able to have, if they're sitting perhaps in the U.S., based out of L.A., even if a registrar or registry was located in the union, the location of the processor wouldn't be as relevant. And I think that could really help within defining any liability concerns for the contract the party has. Secondly, there's the guidance I think was really helped to also, was meant to also give enlightenment on how to determine the proper location or specification of the data subject, so that it's meant to show that really the goal of the GDPR is to really focus that the data subject is in the union, either residing there on a more permanent basis, not necessarily just solely focused on citizenship, so that when it comes to filling out a domain registration, that if the address is provided with the city specification and it's in the EU, then that data subject is, in fact, subject to the GDPR, otherwise not. And so, like if their citizenship, if they were a U.S. citizen otherwise. So it's really trying to hone in on the fact that it's meant to target data subjects that are in the EU, whether it be on a permanent or even temporary basis, that they should, that it's saying that at the time in which they're siphoning the goods or services an issue is the important juncture. So I think that it really provides us with some good guidance that's helpful to our cause.
Thank you, Diane. James, please go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. James speaking, and thanks, Amr, for finding this, walking us through it, and posting it to the list. I, you know, skimmed through this document when it first hit the list, and I think, like Amr, I came away with more questions than answers. I do agree with Margie and Diane that a lot of this guidance is a pivot on the definition of roles, so I think that getting some, you know, the ability to lock that down with regard to ICANN and contracted parties and the various purposes is essential for this to have any impact. But my key takeaway from this memo was just the complexity that it introduces to operators, registrars, and possibly registries that are that are operating globally, that have physical presences all over the world, in and out of the EU, that that have customers all over the globe, and all of the different scenarios that are captured in this guidance, and in fact, a lot of the scenarios that that aren't captured. And that's just for GDPR. There are a number of others. We continue to point out this EPDP is driven by GDPR. That's the impetus for doing this work, but, you know, that's not the only data protection regime that's either out there or has been adopted and will take effect here about, you know, 12 months from now. So I think my key takeaway is that this is helpful, is interesting. I think it emphasizes the need to pin down those roles between ICANN and the parties of who's the controller and who's the processor. But I don't think that there is anything here that you can point to and say that, you know, contracted parties must do X or must not do Y. I think that clearly the complexity of this guidance showcases the complexity of this issue, and I think trying to carve that into stone in a consensus policy or a contract means we'll be right back here in a matter of weeks or months, revising it continuously as those rules change and new scenarios pop up. So that was my takeaway, but I do thank Amr for flagging it. Thanks.
Thank you, James. Amr, go ahead, please.
Oh, thanks, Kurt. This is Amr, and yeah, I think I agree with a lot of what James said, and I'm not sure in what context we might discover that there are contracted parties out there that are not, you know, targeting residents of the EU. That would be interesting to find out if you know, for example, if there is a registrar out there, or even probably more likely in the case of a GTLD registry, but it would be interesting to find out if there are registrars out there that, you know, are specifically not targeting or excluding residents of the EU in who they want to provide services to. But again, the targeting criteria is not just about that. There's also the issue of monitoring the behavior and some of the examples that are in the guidelines, and I find those to be very interesting because identifying a data subject's geographic location is one of them, and this is something that is done with every single domain name registration out there. You know, as we all know, you know, some part of the registration data is the physical address of the registered name holder, and there are purposes why this data is collected. And there are several purposes and for which it is processed beyond the collection. So this, to me, to my reading, and again, I claim no expertise on this at all, but to me, this really identifies one of the issues here in terms of monitoring the behavior, and so within the context of registering domain names, a name holder's behavior is being actively monitored, and the data being collected is being processed. Also, again, I really think that these are things we should seek more clarity on, and I think we need to be sure that when we are doing this, we're not too selective in what little tidbits of the guidelines we want to ask about. We can't, focus on one and ignore some of the others. And again, the establishment criteria, I think, is one that is very interesting. And I'd like to, personally speaking, I'd like to understand it a little better, get more clarity on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Amr. Mark, go ahead.
This strikes me as an area where we could get very targeted legal advice. I mean, this seems to be you could have a very specific case where you just describe a company like VeriSign or describe a company like GoDaddy. Here is a company that conducts their business in such a way, they have in such and such a place. Do they have establishments or not? Are they perceived to be targeting or not? seems to me like this is the kind of legal advice we should be able to get pretty clearly, because we have these very clear examples of multinational companies. You know, in a lot of cases, it's going to be very, very clear without any question. Like we were talking about Dot Berlin, for instance. Okay, they have the establishment in Berlin. It doesn't matter whether all their customers are German or not. They're established, so it applies to all the business they do. So in a lot of cases, it will be very, very straightforward. And in the cases where it's ambiguous, we have real-world examples that we can use to craft the request for legal clarification.
Thank you, Mark. Margie, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Margie. I was going to take it a little further. Like for example, you know, we've talked about the rules engine concept. You know, the chart that I was talking about could really delineate where it, you know, clearly applies and where it doesn't apply. And the answer, I think, one of the observations that James made, even if you are targeting in Europe, if you're an establishment outside of Europe, like say GoDaddy, and let's just assume for the sake of argument that there's no processing activities in Europe. If you have European customers, that data would be subject to GDPR, but your U.S.-based customers would not, or at least that's how I read the report or the guidelines, and that's the kind of thing that we could ask legal clarity on. So that's I think that's what made us very interested in these guidelines. Is that it does draw some lines, and it helps really narrow what kind of questions we want to ask.
Thanks, Margie. Emily, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up the question that Mark from Zurich raised about, you know, asking the specific scenario-based questions to legal counsel. It may work, but you probably just pro forma a sense to say it will be a question of fact in each case. And of course, one of the difficulties that I think particularly registries and particularly registrars have is that if you're advertising your services on a website, regardless of any other targeting that you might do, the likelihood is that people will just come and find you by your services, and that those people might well include EU residents. And so this just adds a complexity in interpreting the application of the GDPR. And I think that this is one of the reasons why quite a conservative approach has been taken in respect to GTLD registration data, because it's, you know, if you're advertising globally, then you're very likely to attract EU residents as your customers. So, okay, thanks.
Thanks, Emily. Go ahead, James.
Thanks, Kurt. James speaking. So, I'm just going back a couple of comments in the discussion, I think, to Margie's point. I think that, if the guidance helps us to draw a box around those data subjects who are covered by GDPR who are not, and I think that, honestly, the guidance is pretty mushy on that point, but if it did, I think that would be helpful. I think the problem is that that's just one of the framework's targets we're trying to hit. And like, for example, the California privacy law that was recently passed but doesn't take effect until January 1st of next year, even if we weren't a global provider, GoDaddy or a company like GoDaddy is not going to write 50 different privacy rule sets for its customers in all the different states, 51 if we throw D.C. in there. So I think that's a good example where, one geographic region, the strictest region in one territory, has to be able to be applied outside of that just for operational practicalities. And I think that in some ways affects applies to GDPR as well, but it is just one star in a constellation of privacy laws that are all kind of coming down on all of our heads right now. And so I think that the guidance here is helpful but not helpful, but it at least demonstrates that this is a very complicated issue, and it's very challenging for providers that are operating across borders, because it really just throws that whole question into, you know, the question of digital versus political borders into sharp relief. So it is challenging. Thanks.
Thank you, James. Hadia, go ahead, please.
First, I would like to agree with Mark S. that this is definitely an area where we could ask precise questions and seek precise legal advice. I have a question to Amr. I don't understand how he related monitoring the behavior. I didn't get what he was saying. Monitoring behavior typically relates to trying to predict preferences, behaviors, attitudes. I didn't get what he said in this regard. Thank you.
Right, Amar. Amar, please go ahead and answer.
Thanks, Kurt, and thanks for the question, Hadia. This is Amar. There are a few examples in the guidelines on monitoring the behavior. And one of them that stood out to me is geolocalized activities. So if for any reason within the processing activities of the controller or a processor, or in the case of these guidelines, also, you know, a stable establishment acting on behalf of the processor or controller within the context of the services being offered, then geolocalization is one type of behavior being monitored that would be applicable here. And the reason why I thought this was relevant to the ICANN context is because during the domain name registration process, each name holder's geographic location has to be the data on that needs to be collected. So you collect the physical address for each name holder, whether it's a natural person or a legal person. So in that sense, and this data is processed further in many cases. You know, we've discussed cases on the EPDP where, you know, for example, in with certain RPMs where this data comes into play, and there are other reasons, other examples of processing activities out there. So since geolocalization is one of the elements in behavior being monitored that qualify for this, I believe this sort of provides some sort of, you know, blanket coverage for domain name registration, the domain name registration process. But again, I have to keep saying I'm not an expert on this, and this is just my reading of the guidelines, and I think we would do well to get further clarity on this. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for that discussion. Let me tell you what my thinking is, and it sort of goes contrary to some of what's been said here. So it's most likely off base, but just as a way to push the conversation a little bit further before we close it off, I'm not sure that procuring legal advice, I don't think we're facing a legal question here. I think we're facing a policy question. And my thinking is that this is a very complex area where, some registrars, registrars will have customers in the EU and outside it. Some will have customers in California where there's a different privacy regime inside the United States and outside it. Some registrars will have relationships where clearly GDPR does not apply, and relationships where it clearly does, and some where it's muddled. And so I think this is the policy question for us is, and it's put well in the temp spec. So the way that I understand the temp spec is it sets out, you know, three conditions. If you meet any one of these three conditions, then with regard to your nexus with the EEA, then you fall under GDPR, and then the temp spec goes on to say, you know, if this becomes, to me, the wording is, if this is very complicated and financially unacceptable to manage, then you can apply, GDPR across the board in your organization. So I think, regardless of the legal advice we get, we're going to be left with this question of whether we want to make a policy that says, registrars and maybe registries are required to sort this difficult situation out and create some sort of compliance regime where that can actually be measured and enforced. So that's one alternative. Another alternative might be, you know, if we think there's a rules engine, which is easy to postulate but difficult, I think, to design, but if we think we want to look into the creation of a rules engine that would alleviate the burden of registrars in trying to make this parsing, we could do that. Or the third option is to leave the temp spec as it is. And, you know, maybe one of our courses here is not to get legal advice, but to get ICANN advice and say, you know, why did you write it this way? What was your thinking in devising it this way? So I don't know. Just to sum up, I think even if we get policy advice, we're going to be left. Even if we get legal advice, we're going to be left with the same sort of policy question we're facing now, where we're in disagreement about whether to leave the temp spec the way it's written or change it. James.
Hey, Kurt, James speaking. I just kind of wanted to plus one your last sentence there. I think it looks like a legal question, but this is really not a legal question, because I think any legal advisor is going to be constrained by whatever, context or jurisdiction they're licensed and trained and accredited and in which they have some expertise. And this is really a question of dealing with things that, dealing with requirements that kind of transcend jurisdictions. And I think it's really gets into some of the operational challenges that a lot of global technology firms are facing now, whether it's a registry or registrar, or whether it's, a service that's trying to deal with local regulations on news, but it's a news aggregator or social network, or whether it's a company like Skype that's trying to, navigate the telecom regulations in two different areas. So I think this is really just one of those types of things where we can get a legal expert to weigh in on jurisdiction X or how it applies inside or outside of jurisdiction X, but it doesn't address all of the possible permutations for a global provider. And so I think that's why this starts to look more like a practical question. Rather than just, let's get some legal advice. So I guess I'm just trying to put an exclamation point on your last question, that this on the surface looks like a question that we just, kick over to the legal experts, but I don't think that what we get back is going to really get us anywhere towards a solution. Anybody there?
Bird, you are on mute.
Yeah, it was me. I must have clicked it twice. So, So, anyway, I'm pleased that Diane and Margie raised their hand because I was going to encourage them to speak up in response. So, Diane, go ahead, please.
Sure. Thanks, Kurt. I think it is certainly a legal question, but the issue, as I've been trying to say all along, and I think we're all sort of saying, and I hear it in James as well, is that it is a legal issue, but in fact these guidelines show that that there's still interpretation being made by the different DPAs, by the different authorities, and it leaves a lot of open questions. And this puts businesses in a very difficult position. So as I feel I've been trying to put forth to others is that it causes businesses to have to come up with operational practicalities on how to handle it. And I think you're saying that as well, Kurt, that we're going to have to come to a point where we land someplace trying to evaluate the law the best we can in as low risk a way for the contracted party house or ICANN as possible and set up a system that is, you know, can functionally be applied and work, and how we determine that is to best look like is what we're working on here. But I think that we certainly could try to work through the legal issues the best that we can. Whether we're ever going to get to a place on certain of these nuances is going to be challenging because there's a lot of complexities here. So we have to just push forward. I think we should get more legal advice on this, and certainly we could work on it in the legal committee and then hopefully come to a consensus on what we think is the most reasonably low risk and practical application from a policy standpoint.
Thanks, Diane. Margie, go ahead, please.
Sure. I have a little different perspective on this. I mean, I know we've been talking about costs to the contracted parties, but we're also ignoring the costs to the third parties that access WHOIS. And there's a balance there as well. I mean, it's no surprise to anyone that the costs have gone dramatically up for anyone who's doing brand protection and trying to enforce their rights or do even cybersecurity investigations. So if you're talking about costs, it's not a one-way conversation. It's a two-way conversation. And I think that's something that gets lost in this group sometimes. The other perspective that I think I'd like to share is that, you know, we all know that there's different laws with different applications and that there are activities underway to introduce legislation that might even address this particular issue. Whether or not that happens, we obviously don't know what will happen in the next cycle in the United States or other countries. But we have to be prepared to have a policy that accepts having a different standard depending upon geography, because the reality is there will be different laws. And so if we adopt one approach across the board, we're just going to have to go back to it, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now when the law changes. So that's something that I think that's one of the reasons why I've been advocating for the rules engine concept, because that is something that would be flexible enough to accommodate changes in law should that happen. And so I just wanted to flag both of those issues.
What's your understanding of the rules engine, Margie? Who should be, you know, as postulated some time ago, was there any effort or anybody on this list, was there any effort to pursue that, or was there a team identified that should be pursuing it?
Sure. And what happened was there was the expert working group report that was commissioned by the ICANN board. And then what happened after, once that the board received the report, it initiated a policy development process. That was the next generation WHOIS that was kicked off because of the EWG final report. And then that got stalled when GDPR came into play. So unfortunately, it was never fully acted on or investigated. But I do think that that's something that we should have as a policy recommendation to see the feasibility of that. Because, I can certainly talk about, you know, in the business sector, businesses do apply different rules depending upon where their customers are. That's just the reality of doing business globally. And so when I hear James say, oh, we have to keep the cost down, you have to keep in mind that if a company makes an affirmative decision to market in a particular region, it's not just GDPR they have to comply with. They have to comply with any other laws that apply to those services. And that's just the cost of doing business. And we should assume that the costs are going to vary depending upon what the business decides to target and the services that they offer. So that's why I just want to raise the cost issue as it being a much more complex issue than simply looking at what the contracted party's costs are.
Thanks, Margie. And I wonder too. You don't have to respond to this one, but I wonder too to what extent we can actually quantify those costs. You know, anyway, on both sides, I think it'd be meaningful. Alan, welcome to the meeting. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Can you hear me? I'm using a new setup, so I'm not sure how well it works.
You sound better than you ever have.
Marvelous. Working from an airline lounge, I guess, is a plus sometimes. Look, this is clearly a policy issue, but I don't think getting legal advice is going to help. Is ultimately we have to make decisions. I think on the long run, when we start factoring in laws in other jurisdictions, and particularly laws which may be more stringent than GDPR or less stringent, or in fact require disclosure of certain information, which GDPR may forbid, I think ultimately everyone will have to go to a rules-based engine, a table-driven algorithm that is flexible enough to handle the multiple laws. I don't think we should be looking at it now. We have a complex enough problem to get compliance with GDPR in a tight timeline. But I think ultimately that is where we're going to be moving. I don't think there's any choice. Right now we have a number of clear cases. Organizations present in the EU have to apply GDPR. Organizations present outside of the EU, that target, and that's a well undefined term, those within the EU have to follow it. If you don't target it, you don't have to follow it. Target customers in the EU, you don't have GDPR applying. But on the other hand, there are other cases. We have registrars registries in various parts of the world that, you know, don't have any interfaces in languages that people in Europe tend to understand, certainly not European-based languages. And these people are clearly not targeting anyone. They're not present. And the question is, do we really want to allow them to redact everything ostensibly because of GDPR when there's not a hair of a connection between them and GDPR applicable areas? So I think ultimately we have to make decisions, and I agree strongly with Margie that just looking at the cost of contracted parties don't think gives you the whole picture. There are risks associated with not having information. We'll have talked about that in the past, and there are costs associated with it. We haven't gotten a clear answer from ICANN compliance, for instance, but I suspect it is taking them significantly more manpower to address every complaint they get in than it did before. Somehow we have to factor that in. I don't think it's going to be easy to quantify. Thank you.
So I'll just take one more shot at this and then we'll leave it. But so I kind of see three pools of contracted parties. Those that clearly fall into the three criteria in the temp spec that must apply GDPR, a set of registries and registrars that address local markets that do not have to apply GDPR, and maybe for those cases, it would not be optional for them to apply it. And third, a set of contracted parties where there's sets of customers that where GDPR applies, and maybe sets of customers where it doesn't, and sets of customers where it's uncertain. And so, one approach might be to say that, you know, there's three, that the TUBS might be amended to say there's these three pools, and they, and for that last pool where it's where there's where there's difficulties or confusion, that the application of GDPR remains optional as described in the TEMP spec, pending research or not just a feasibility study but much more, the design of some sort of machine that can make that parsing in an effective and legally compliant way, or some other legal determination that we learn as this evolves. So is that sort of where we are? Alan? We'll go in alphabetical order. Alan?
That's certainly a possibility and closer to where I believe we want to be. But you know, how do you avoid gaming in that? How do you avoid a registrar in somewhere in Asia who, you know, puts up a website that looks like they're specifically targeting registrants in Germany just to be able to apply GDPR and have a data-free registration service?
You know, So I don't know. So if that's what they want to do, I guess that might be difficult to stop. And I think one of the issues is not just, you know, creating our policies and then implementing them, but implementing them in a way that they're enforceable, that the rules are clear and can be enforced. So I don't know. Amr?
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amr. I would suggest that we need to do a bit more work on before we recommend any sort of research into a potential rules engine or any sort of investment at all, actually. I would be concerned that, you know, if resources are poured into something like this, then that in itself might create some sort of perceived justification to implement it. I think before we make a recommendation to even research a rules engine, we need to be very sure that it would be a viable option from, you know, in terms of factors other than technical ones. So I just think we need to think this out a little further. Thank you.
You think we need to do research in order to determine if we should do research, something like that? Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Thank you. I agree with Amr, but for different reasons. The problem we're talking about today could be addressed by a rules engine. It's a really, really simple rules engine. But I don't think there's going to be an awful lot of parameters in it. So, yes, it could technically be a rules engine, but, you know, I don't think it deserves that name, that lofty name. Ultimately, I believe we will need a rules engine when we start addressing laws in multiple jurisdictions, not just interpretations of one set of laws, as we're looking at right here. And I think that's way out of our scope. I think it's the direction that we and ICANN and contracted parties have to aim in, but it's not something that should be in our critical path. What we need is something simple enough that we don't need an elaborate rules engine with multiple dimensions. We're only looking at one dimension here, only looking at one clause. meningitis doesn't warrant it, and I couldn't imagine putting that effort into it in our critical path.
I'm afraid
I'm going to have to leave the call now.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining, Alan. I don't see it as being on our critical path, but I do see it as a difficult problem, sort of a three-body problem. Margie, go ahead.
Sure. I wanted to raise Amr's concern or address that I think it's okay to say, if we're researching it, that doesn't mean we're necessarily going to go down that path, because I do agree. If in analyzing a rule engine, it just becomes overly complicated, and we may not go there from a policy perspective, and that's okay to acknowledge that up front. But I think we're sort of talking about it in the dark if we haven't at least done some sort of analysis related to that. And the other kind of thing I wanted to raise too is the our policy recommendations don't have to be implemented right away. And in other words, we could come up with some recommendations that perhaps kick off a separate process that relates to things like like we might say our policy immediately is this, but we see merit in investigating and researching these elements and updating the policy later if depending upon the analysis. So it's because what I worry about is otherwise we tend to go to the quickest, simplest answer because we're looking at this timeline of having the report done in a month, right? And so I just wanted to flag that we do have that ability to make recommendations that go in a different phase.
Thanks, Margie. I think that's the right approach. So let me I think the best path from here is for us to make this summarize this in some sort of brief writing for the group review, and then maybe we can modify that wording as something that would go into the final report. So I heard that a rules engine, something that should be explored, that it's likely to take some time to develop, and that that research should be set up in a careful way so that that it should be done in a careful way, so not to set certain expectations or certain expected outcomes, and that we should examine in preparation for a final report. We might we'll do some study of the relative costs associated with the different costs on both sides, and then that paragraph would include the different types of contracted parties and where GDPR would attach and where it would be optional and where it wouldn't attach. So I'll undertake to write that up with the team. Emily?
Thanks, Kurt. I'm really confused about how we suddenly got into discussing rules engine, which seems to be an implementation question, and I'm not even sure what policy we're discussing or we've agreed to. I think that finding a draft recommendation on a rules engine at this stage seems a little bit like putting the cart before the horse at this stage. I might just have completely misunderstood, but I'm really confused about how we suddenly spent all this time discussing a rules engine, and I don't understand where it fits in with the agenda or how it fits in with our discussions on the specification. Thank you.
I think that, the more I talk, the more I get myself into trouble. But, I think that the comments by many on this call, almost everybody, indicated the level of complexity involved in trying to make this parsing for contracted parties that do business globally. And the costs associated with that. Despite that, some of us would like to see that contracted parties do this parsing and comply with GDPR or redact, not redact data, depending on sets of circumstances associated with different registrations. So some people think that's tremendously costly or impossible. So what I've heard on this call is that the elements of the temp spec as written would remain essentially the same, except for, you know, indicating that if clearly a contracted party fell outside the EEA in all its business dealings, GDPR wouldn't attach. But that further study into the creation of a rules engine or some mechanism that makes the parsing feasible on a registrant by registrant basis can be done, and that would be the end of our work, and then we'd hand that research into research work off to another party. Not clear, huh? Right. So I'm reading James' response, and those are the terms of reference of this research, right? You know, should a rules engine be built to accommodate laws as they change, so they can be added to the pachinko machine? Will it be created at the expense of ICANN and made free to registrars? And will it be, you know, cheap and easy to implement and also reliable? So those are a number of the challenges for it. Alan?
Thanks. So I think one of the biggest questions I would have with the way you just put it there, Kurt, is quite simply, you know, who are we to define this? I mean, why would we need to do the research for this? Wouldn't this be the job of another policy development process completely? We're stepping beyond the realms of what we should be doing here. I mean, again, sticking to our scope, our scope is to see whether or not a consensus policy can be confirmed from the terms of the temporary specification. And as we're saying, it can be at the moment, but, you know, it allows us to be compliant. But again, I've nothing against saying, however, you know, perhaps this could be worked on in a future policy development, full stop. I don't think we should be defining the terms of them by any stretch of the imagination as members of this EPDP. We just need to, I mean, there's nothing stopping us from saying it needs to be looked at in the future, but for this moment, we can confirm the temporary specification as it allows us to be compliant, full stop. We create so much more work for ourselves in this process by second-guessing what might be done in the future when we really need to be focusing on how we are processing today and can we confirm the temporary specification as written. So, I mean, I really think, you know, we've answered this question. We should be putting a full stop on this and moving forward.
Thanks, Alan. And I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying, especially about creating work for ourselves. I think I was trying to respond to Amr's concern that, you know, without some, you know, if this team were saying this should be looked into in the future, to put some wording around that so it's managed carefully. So I was trying to do that, but however we want to word it is fine with me. Margie, please go ahead.
Sure. A couple things. I mean, I guess I don't look at our scope in the same way that Alan does, because we're talking about having a policy that is not just GDPR compliant, but, you know, and that's the reason that the rules engine is important, is that we're acknowledging that there would be different rules. So I don't think I would support waiting for some future process. I think a recommendation that the work begin immediately, in light of the fact that, you know, there's recognition that this is a complex issue, you know, differing rules, that sort of thing. So that's that's just what I wanted to suggest, that it's important to keep to have some more affirmative, if you will, a policy recommendation because of the differing laws that might come up.
Thanks, Margie. And I too want to be crystal clear that the recommendation would not be that a rules engine be created, but that future research be conducted on the feasibility,
yeah,
and after that decisions and recommendations can be made.
Oh, sure. And I'm sorry, I had one other point. The other thing we haven't talked about in this group that we, if we get to the access discussion, we might start talking about is the ICANN hub and spoke model, right? I mean, and the unified access model scenario, if that's to, you know, ever come to fruition, you could see that it actually may be very appropriate for ICANN to have this rules engine concept. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that this idea might, addressing some of the issues that James suggested, who develops it, who maintains it, Christina, I think, asked, where would the money come from? Those are all great questions, and we should explore it. But I think that if we end up in a situation where the hub and spoke model is something that emerges, then the rules engine fits in nicely, and so I just want to make sure that it's something that we include in our recommendations, but not necessarily with an immediate effect, because that's not. I mean, I recognize that, but that's a time, and it'll take time to do, and analysis as to whether it should be done at all to have a policy that follows that approach.
Thanks, Margie. So I'll do my best with the help of the support team. We'll probably do most of it to write up a potential policy recommendation for us so we can renew our discussion. I'm following the chat and talking about money and the source of the money, and that all goes to how specifically we want to be in our policy recommendation. Do we just want to do further research on the feasibility of it, or do we want to write terms around, cost and responsibilities? And I brought you digital archery, James. So let's go on to the next topic, and I'm going to ask the ICANN staff to lead this. This is the policy change impact analysis and what's been included in the initial report. So could you guys pull that up and take us through that?
Yes, Kurt, this is Marika. I'm just going to scroll to the relevant page in the document so I can all take you there to the same section. So per the charter, and I think this is a general requirement for all PDP working groups, there's a need to include a policy impact analysis. Basically, that impact analysis is expected to set out a set of metrics to measure the effectiveness of the policy change and including source or baseline of data for that purpose. And the main objective in that regard is to kind of measure, to be able to measure the impact of the policy recommendations. Did they achieve what the group set out to do? And that, of course, and also allows, over time to review and potentially, course correct or make modification if the objectives that were set out were not achieved. So what is currently in there is fairly general language, noting that this is probably something that the group needs to further consider. But again, it is something that the group is expected to complete or provide information on for its final report. And so we just wanted to flag this and maybe see if there are any ideas or suggestions around, you know, what should be captured here. Maybe there are even volunteers that would be willing to write up some of the language for this section. And again, I think this is all, you know, part of at least the GNSO's objective to have more data-driven policy development to be able to measure the impact of recommendations and to be able as well then to review over time whether recommendations have the desired impact. So again, you know, this would allow then as well from an ICANN side, for example, to put certain measuring tools in place to measure the effect. But again, you know, some guidance is needed or some further information is needed on the expectations of you know, what information should be tracked, you know, what kind of results would demonstrate if anyone has any suggestions on this, you know, for any volunteers that would like to work on this section in preparation for the final report. Heard you, maybe on mute.
I didn't know I was obligated to respond. I thought you were asking for volunteers.
Yes, but I don't see any hands. So I don't know if that means if no one is willing to work on this. I do know that I think for the charter drafting effort, I think Stephanie, who I don't see on the call today, you know, had a specific interest in this part and I think made a number of you know, edits to this specific charter requirement. So, you know, I'm happy to reach out to her to see if she might be willing to put more meat on the bones or at least has some ideas on what should be captured here. So maybe that's a starting point if no one else is willing to put up their hand or share any ideas or suggestions you may have.
Thanks, Diane. I think you might be overtaxed, though, with working on these relationship aspects and controller agreements and also the legal committee. Maybe the way to look at this is what's in the initial report now, and how this is obviously an area where practically none of us have paid attention. So, you know, what's in the initial report now, and what's the minimum requirement to satisfy? What's the minimum product to satisfy this requirement? I think the initial report identifies some of the policies, right, that are affected.
Yeah, Kurt, what you see on the screen is the language that's currently in the report. The bullet points actually come from the charter. So those kind of set out what the group is expected
right.
to do. So, you know, determining the policy goals, you know, identify, you know, determine a set of questions, you know, determine a set of metrics. And again, it may be, you know, fairly straightforward. You know, one of the objectives, obviously, is GDPR compliance. You know, how can you measure that, you know, after implementation of this policy? Were any cases initiated with DPAs that noted that, you know, it wasn't in compliance? So, again, I think there are certain things that may be fairly easy to kind of write up, but it's still good, you know, and as well, if there are any specific metrics that you think should be followed, you know, anything that compliance should start tracking, for example, and again, it could be the number of complaints in relation to, you know, certain aspects of the policy recommendations, as that may give insight to, you know, did the group solve an issue or create an issue, and as such, you know, what, if anything, could be done to kind of correct that.
So I just got my manager hat on here and trying to, you know, I'm sitting at my desk trying to figure out a place to put this task. And if people on this team can't undertake it, I kind of have sympathy for that. So then, is this a task we, you know, could put to alternates? Is this, Mark, do you have an idea?
Hey, Kurt, it's Mark Anderson. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, perfect.
Okay, great. So a couple thoughts. So I guess first, when you teed up this conversation. I thought this was going to be a conversation about where this policy has impacts on other policies. But that's not what I heard from Marika. What Marika has described is language on how this policy will be judged as effective, and how compliance or the GNSO Council might look at the implementation of this policy and determine if it's meeting its needs and goals. So I guess to be clear, I think both are important tasks that we have to undertake. But I guess I'm wondering if now's the right time to talk about how you would consider judging the effectiveness of this policy when we have a number of outstanding policy items that we're still considering. My concern is that it might be a little premature to start talking about how you would determine the effectiveness of the policy. Did the policy achieve its goals? When considering where we are at this stage of the working group. So, to be clear, I do think both are important activities that we have to undertake. I'm just not sure the right time. Marika's saying in chat, per the charter, this is expected to be included in the final report. Yeah, no problem with that. It should be, but, so are the final policy recommendations. And I think we need to know what those final policy recommendations are before we start having a conversation about measuring the effectiveness of those policy recommendations. That was my thinking as I listened to this. Thanks, Kurt.
Go ahead, Marika.
Yes, so this is Marika. So one suggestion that I may make there then, because I understand that it's hard to do this when you haven't finalized your recommendations yet, but noting the time there, there's likely going to be very little time between agreeing to the policy recommendations and producing a final report. So one suggestion I can maybe make there as the policy impact analysis as such are not policy recommendations, and as such they need to go through the council approval or board approval for the policy recommendations to take effect. Maybe you could put in language here that kind of explains the situation the group was in and kind of take as an action item that following the final report, this is something you work on and it's kind of delivered separately to the GNSO Council and ICANN board if needed, if there are specific requests that metrics that ICANN org needs to implement, it probably will also need to go to the board, to direct staff to do that. So maybe that is a way to kind of address the concern that you don't have final recommendations, but also note that there is a time crunch while still not forgetting that this is an important part of the work. So that may be a way of dealing with this section to kind of take it out of here and deal with it separately so that due consideration can be given to it once you've agreed to the policy recommendations.
Thanks, Marika, for that. Emily, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Marika, for drawing this to the group's attention. That's completely appropriate. I do, however, share the views of Mark and I think Margie on the chat to say that, at this stage it's slightly just to conduct such an analysis before we have anything close to policy recommendations on most of the issues. So I think it's something that we all need to bear in mind as a task to be completed prior to the publication of the final report, and thank you very much for drawing it to our attention in that way. I don't think it's something that we can start to work on yet. I think it would be not a productive use of time at this stage. Thanks.
Thanks. This is such a, I don't want to say odd, and I keep saying how we're different from every other policy development group, but it's different in that we're not creating a new sort of policy, for example, for
how to transfer domain names from one registrar to another, or something where there's some sort of measurable output, but rather we're trying to bring ourselves into compliance with GDPR. And so I wonder if, I wonder if we could take each of the existing policy recommendations and see what metrics or measures there are, you know, pretty easily, and attach those alongside for the group's review or something like that. So I'm sensitive, you know, I'm sensitive to the arguments people make about timing. I'm more sensitive to the fact that we're tremendously busy trying to get done. So I think what we'll do is leave this for now. I'll collaborate with staff to see if there's some independent resource that can kind of, you know, take a shot at this and then we'll gin something up so we agree with it at the end of the day or something like that, you know. Or our last policy recommendation is to get somebody to fill out this last part of the charter. Okay, so let's let this go, and then so I think it's just about time to close the meeting. Is there any action items from the staff? Oh, Ashley, I'm sorry. Did you have your hand up?
I did, but I don't want to prolong it. I guess I just in wanting to avoid looking like nobody wants to do it. I'm happy to volunteer to work on this issue. I guess similar to everyone else, I would just hate to dedicate time to something and then find out something changes as a result of getting input to the initial report. But that being said, you know, I'm happy to volunteer once we decide it's best to start looking at this conflicts with policy issue.
Thanks, Ashley. Okay, then let's leave this for now. So, Marika, do we have action items or Caitlin?
Hi, Kurt. This is Caitlin for the transcript. I did capture one action item, which is for you, and that is to summarize the geographic differentiation discussion and draft a policy recommendation for the group to review and ultimately be included in the final.
Great. Okay, does anybody have any closing comments? Let everybody go. Great. Well, thanks again, everyone, for being on the call, the constructive discussion, and hanging in there. Thanks very much, and have a great day.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Ed, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.